Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Join me Mondays at noon as we explore the universal energy that connects us all. Let's discuss our journey of self-discovery, joy, presence, and living with authenticity. We can create positive change in the world, and it starts within each one of us. Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Mondays at noon on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Hello and welcome to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard. Happy holidays, happy Hanukkah, and I'm going to have one more week of Synchronicity for the year, and then the building will be closed on Christmas Eve, so just letting you know that. This is CITR 101.9 FM here in Vancouver, or you might also be listening in Kamloops at CFBX, or in Nova Scotia at Axe Radio Canada, or online at CITR.ca, CosmicDimensions.com, EmpowerRadio.com, or on the Co-Creator Network. And wherever you're listening from, I hope that you are having a wonderful holiday season. Today we're speaking with a psychologist from the Vancouver Psychotherapy Center. His name is Dr. Lauren Corman, and we're going to be speaking about dialectical behavioral therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, and maybe we'll ask him about some other things. So if you have a question and you want to ask him on the air, give us a call, 604-822-2487. That's 604-822-2487. But he won't be giving like psychological evaluations over the air, obviously, because there are professional ethics that he has to abide by. But if you have general questions about psychology and psychotherapy, then please do feel free to give us a call, 604-822-2487. Welcome to the show, Dr. Corman.
Thanks for having me on.
So thank you for being with us. And now, can you please tell us a little bit about your background and what you do at the Vancouver Psychotherapy Center?
Well, I got my PhD at York University in clinical psychology, and I was really interested in emotions, particularly the use of emotions in psychotherapy. I was trained, actually, in emotion-focused therapy, which actually didn't work as well, I think, with folks who were really dysregulated, who had a lot of behavioral and emotional problems. And I started to get more interested in DBT, dialectical behavior therapy, which was a treatment that was originally designed for work with people with borderline personality disorder. I moved to Vancouver from Toronto about 6 years ago and worked with a group mostly of psychiatrists, but we're a multidisciplinary group at the Vancouver Psychotherapy Center, working with families and youth and young adults and adults.
Wonderful. So now tell us, can you tell us, please, about dialectical behavioral therapy and what, so now it's used for more than just borderline personality disorder at this point, but it was developed by a woman in Seattle who has borderline personality disorder, and it's been shown as very effective treatment for that, as well as a number of other issues. So what is borderline personality disorder?
Well, borderline personality disorder is personality disorder, first of all. It's a disorder that is mostly diagnosed in women, so something about somewhere around 80% of the folks who are diagnosed with the disorder are women. It's characterized by emotional dysregulation, emotions being out of control, sometimes intense anger. Often what you'll see is that people will act quite impulsively in ways that are self-harming, so the, in a way that some people would regard the hallmark of borderline personality disorder as being a history of being suicidal or deliberate self-harm. It's quite common. You see that with BPD. Often there are problems also in relationships, so people will get into very, very intense relationships and tend to put other people on a bit of a pedestal, and then when they're disappointed in their relationships, they tend to devalue the other person. There's also problems with the self, with the experience of the self, so people might feel hollow inside or empty inside or not really sure who they are. And sometimes when people's emotions are really intense, their thinking also gets a bit frazzled, and so they can be paranoid under intense distress or even be dissociative in times where they're very, very intensely emotionally distressed. But the hallmark really is that the emotions, these folks are, their emotions are, can be really labile. So when something happens in the environment, their emotions can get really, really quickly dysregulated. And then other problems with relationships, with the self, and with their behaviors really are, in a way, driven by their intense emotions.
Thank you for that explanation, Dr. Corman. The connection seems to be really bad. I don't know if you're hearing it breaking up.
I don't. So I'm on a landline.
Is it possible that I could get you to call me right back? I'm going to play an ad, and then hopefully we'll have a better connection.
Sure, I'll call you right back.
Okay, thank you so much. So this is Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul, and we'll be back with more synchronicity momentarily. Thank you.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news, as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Last year, over 650 BC teens aged out of foster care without a permanent family.
Adoption is not just for babies. Teens need families too. Only 24 teens in BC were adopted last year.
November is Adoption Awareness Month. To find out more about adopting a teen, contact the Adoptive Families Association of BC. Call 1-877-ADOPT-07 or visit us at bcadopt.com.
Welcome back to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and we are speaking with Dr. Lauren Corman. He is from the Vancouver Psychotherapy Center, and we're just talking right now about borderline personality disorder, which is what originally dialectical behavioral therapy was intended for. So what other things is DBT being used for now?
I guess the big one, there's some evidence actually supporting its use with folks who have problems with binge eating disorders. And there's some research by our group actually, like a randomized control trial data, showing that the treatment and adaptations of the treatment work well for people with anger problems and sometimes also people with anger and substance use problems. And the research also was extended for people with borderline personality disorder and substance use problems in a couple of research trials. Now, the research, even though there isn't a lot of research supporting this, the treatment's also been extended for work with adolescents and their families, particularly like a suicidal, impulsive adolescents and their families.
So how is a suicidal adolescent different than someone with borderline personality disorder, which you just said one of the big red flags for BPD is that they're suicidality?
Well, I guess it's a good question. It raises the whole question of what a personality disorder is. A personality disorder, at least if you look at the psychiatric, the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for the American Psychiatric Association, the idea of a personality disorder is that person really has problems that are pervasive, like that are long-lasting. And so when working with adolescents, they're really usually too young to make any kind of formal diagnosis of personality disorder because you see problems in youth and young adults that are sometimes they're just kind of age-appropriate. You see much more impulsive behaviors in youth. But even when a young person becomes suicidal, it's a bit usually too early to label the adolescent as having a personality disorder. So you want to actually see the behavior hopefully not occurring over a longer period of time.
Thank you. And so what is the difference? Maybe we could talk about what dialectical behavioral therapy looks like. Now, it's similar to cognitive behavioral therapy, which I'm sure a lot of listeners have heard of. So what's the difference between dialectical behavioral therapy and cognitive behavioral therapy?
Yeah, so it's similar in some ways, and it's very not similar. It's very dissimilar in other ways. The cognitive behavioral therapy focuses primarily on changing clients' ways of thinking, and to some degree also focuses on changing people's behaviors. DBT focuses much more on clients' emotions first. So in DBT, there are four main In a comprehensive DBT, there are four main components of treatment. Clients undergo individual therapy, but it's primarily skills-based. So clients also undergo, they participate every week in essentially a classroom where they learn skills. And they learn skills focusing on emotion regulation, on being mindful, learning how to be here and now in the moment, to make decisions based on their own wisdom, to be able to be non-judgmental, to be able to see things as they are rather than kind of see things through the prism of their own opinions, to be able to be more interpersonally effective, to be more like assertive, and to be able to tolerate their own distress, to be able to get through painful life events without making things worse. But the focus really is much more on being mindful and learning how to tolerate emotions and how to regulate or even modulate or change emotions. And that isn't really a focus of cognitive behavior therapy. And one of the reasons that Marshall Linehan originally thought that CBT was not a really good match for people who were emotionally dysregulated was that a lot of the folks who, about 75% of people who meet criteria for borderline personality disorder have some history of abuse. And often that's associated with being told that reality is a certain way, reality being foisted on them in a certain way. And so because CBT really focuses on helping clients change how they think, the idea is that, well, first help people regulate their emotions first, because when your emotions are really frazzled, it's really hard to kind of think clearly. And so two things. One is that it's hard to kind of go back to people who've experienced really invalidating childhoods and tell them actually to change the way that they're thinking, number one. And number two, when the folks' emotions are really frazzled, the first thing that really needs to be addressed is getting their emotions under control, because it's like a fire alarm system. Hard to really to do anything else. Emotions really are, they grab our attention, and they really focus people's behaviors and attention very, very intensely.
Thank you, Doctor. I don't know if I should call you Dr. Lauren or Dr.
Call me
Corman.
Lauren,
okay. So I'm curious now, people who have borderline personality disorder, like you said, it's very pervasive. This is going on a long period of time. It's really affecting all aspects of their lives. But what about people who, like, as an example, would listen to this show and are looking to have more regulation over their emotions, have more control over their thoughts? A lot of times in the new age spiritual world, there are things like affirmations and meditation. So how can DBT type skills help people who might not have a personality disorder but are still struggling with the regular daily? Because for me, it seems kind of confusing when you talk about feelings of like emptiness and stuff. A lot of people in the world have those feelings, and they don't have personality disorders.
Absolutely. That's absolutely true. Well, one thing is that DBT is, in large measure, DBT is it's not necessarily an original therapy. Marcia said that one of the things she did was she cobbled together pieces and parts of different therapies and different, even mindfulness, which is really not necessarily, wasn't before primarily a therapeutic method, were taken and kind of cobbled together to form something new into a new form of therapy. There are lots of parts of DBT that are useful for folks who, as you said, may not meet criteria for borderline personality disorder. And it's not that they have to actually do DBT at all. I'm not shilling DBT for the masses. It's just that things like learning how to actually, for example, act from wisdom or even meditate, which is now becoming actually much more prominent part of CBT, mindfulness practice, are going to be useful to people regardless of whether or not they meet criteria for personality disorder.
Now, I'm also curious, the emotion regulation, the mindfulness, the interpersonal effectiveness, and the distress tolerance skills, these are some they seem like some of the most basic skills. Yet, I mean, I've been in dialectical behavioral therapy for a couple of years now, and I didn't get these skills growing up. And I actually come across a lot of people now that I have all these skills. The frustration is that a lot of people in the world don't have these most basic skills. So one of the reasons that I wanted to do this show is to shed light on some of these skills and how people can get access to them, and whether DBT or CBT or some other type of therapy might be helpful to them. I'm just wondering what your opinion is on why these skills aren't being taught just openly in the world.
Oh, I think that's a really good question. I mean, I think to some degree, I didn't get taught these skills either when I was a kid. And I think that to some degree, some of these skills are imparted by parents just in normal, healthy upbringings. These skills are imparted by parents to their children. And they're not necessarily conveyed as skills. So, for example, a few years ago, I was visiting a friend and his young son. And his kid was crying, and his son wanted to play with a screwdriver. And so my friend took the screwdriver away, and his son got more and more upset. So the son stood by his kid, said, you know, hey, I know you're really, really upset. You still can't play with a screwdriver because you're going to hurt yourself. And here, like, why don't we just sit together and until you calm down? Well, that isn't necessarily thought of as a skill. It's just good parenting. But just by that communication, his son is actually going to learn how to regulate himself, right? Just by sitting next to his father is soothing him. There's a lot of modeling that's taking place. Plus, the kid is learning how to regulate himself in the moment. That often isn't the case, particularly in environments that are functioning less well. So where parents might either not be around as much, or whether they may, struggling on their own. And so some of us learn these skills, some of us don't learn these skills, unfortunately. Some of us may be coming from really functional backgrounds and still not learn these skills and still need them.
Wonderful. So I'm curious how your life has changed, because I know with the therapist that I've been working with using DBT, that they often say to me, like, oh, I've used this skill and this really helped me. And until they learned it, until they started teaching it to their clients, it wasn't really a full part of their life. So how has teaching and using DBT in your practice helped you?
I think it really has. I think the skills, I mean, again, they're not just DBT skills, but I think these skills have helped me a lot. Like I said, I also didn't learn these skills growing up. I think I knew some of these skills, just not by any formal training from my parents or anybody else. But I think, for one thing, learning how to radically accept, there's this idea in DBT of radical acceptance, radically accepting things that you can't change that are painful and hard, either that are happening now or that happened in the past. Now, it's a very difficult kind of concept for people, including myself, to fully digest, but the idea is that when people can radically accept very, very painful events, that it doesn't take the pain away, but it may reduce suffering. And so that idea or that concept or that practice has been incredibly important for me, I think particularly in the last few years, going through very painful life events. I think most DBT therapists have mindfulness practice, and you will find, like you do with your therapist, that most DBT therapists, I think, are walking the walk. We used to, psychologists used to teach clients, you know, I think there was that it was really important to express in the 60s and 70s, it was really important to express what you feel and to act on feelings. Now, actually, we're learning that, for example, if you want to get anger down, anger doesn't come out. The way to reduce the intensity of anger is actually to not act on it, or to actually change anger into feelings of warmth. So, for example, if I'm angry, if I'm really angry, you will find me smiling. One of the ways that I know, my wife is Buddhist, and one of the ways I can reliably tell that she's that I've done something that would have bothered her is that I will find her doing a little half smile. And I know, even though she didn't formally learn that skill, that that's a method that she's got to kind of re-regulate herself, I think, that she's actually changing anger into something, into calmness.
So that's interesting, Lauren. I want to talk more about these emotions and how we can change them, and what you said about anger, how getting it out, because some therapies would have you like hitting something or punching something. So it sounds like you're saying that that actually doesn't get rid of the anger. In fact, it can help it to build.
Part of the therapies that I learned growing up were like that. You know, we're taught to help clients smash a chair with a wiffle bat. And it's not that there's no usefulness to that, but the usefulness of that kind of emotional expression was way overstated. And it's, you know, for people who are very, very inhibited, for example, a person who's very, very, who's been dominated by their spouse for 20 years and who's never expressed any anger, helping the person to direct, focus, experience, and direct their anger in an appropriate way, right, in a non-abusive way, is incredibly helpful to somebody in that kind of situation therapeutically. But for people who are angry a lot, it's doing that, getting them to express more anger, is quite unhelpful. So, for example, if there was this belief before that, you know, you smash a, you know, what do they call those Bobo dolls, those blow-up dolls, smash a Bobo doll or take a wiffle bat and smash a chair, and that you could get anger out of you. I mean, it partly came from a psychoanalytic concept years ago. But there really isn't there isn't scientific support for that. And so when people express anger, they activate the parts of their brain that are associated with more angry thoughts. They will begin to have more angry thoughts available to them, and they will feel angrier. So expressing an emotion tends to beget more of that emotion. If people want, it's all up to the person, right? So it's not that we're trying to change people against their will. But if people are coming into therapy with saying, hey, you know, I'm angry a lot, I want to get less angry, one of the ways to get less angry is actually to express the opposite emotion, to express kindness or warmth or compassion, or in the worst case scenario, to kind of retreat gently from the situation. I ran an anger clinic in Toronto for many years at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health. Many of our clients who came into the anger and addiction clinic, thought that they need to express more anger. But that's why they were there in the treatment for the first place, because they had such huge anger problems. The problem was that they actually didn't know how to re-regulate their anger.
Interesting, Lauren. So I'm confused now about the anger, I guess, because sometimes it's important to express your emotions.
Absolutely.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that you don't stop yourself from feeling the anger. I guess there's different techniques, right? Because there's sometimes you might use opposite emotion. So you would do an activity that creates a different emotion in you, the opposite of what you're feeling. But there are also times when you would just sit and notice the emotion, correct?
Absolutely. Really good point. Yes. So the important thing is, first of all, for the person to even be aware that they're feeling angry, right? So that the skill that's focused on helping people be aware of what they're feeling is mindfulness. And so some people are aware that they're angry. Some people express anger without even being aware of it. I remember a person in our clinic in Toronto who was raging and angry, screaming, "I'm not angry, I'm not angry." Half the hospital was in the corridor shaking their heads because this person was raging. But he wasn't lying. He really didn't know that he was feeling angry. That happens. So it's a matter of, first of all, being aware of what you're feeling, number one. And it's hard, right? And then being able to have some control over the emotion so that the emotion's not overwhelming. And then figuring out whether or not to express it and how intensely to express it. So just because you're angry at your boss doesn't mean that you go and express it every time, right?
Well, my next question, Lauren, is about, because anger, isn't anger a secondary emotion? So couldn't someone who is raging, as you described, not realize that they're angry because really they're really sad and hurt and frustrated? And so all of that combination is what's anger.
So anger can be a primary or secondary emotion. So you're right that anger sometimes is a secondary emotion. I'll explain the difference. All human beings on the planet are born with a propensity for experiencing and expressing anger. It's one of the things that really defines us as human beings. So regardless of where you are on the planet, doesn't matter if you're in Japan or Canada or in some jungle in the Amazon that has had no contact with other folks, people will tend to make the same faces regardless of what culture they come from. So, and they'll make the same faces in response to the same situations, and we think that if they're basically experiencing the same types of emotions, emotions like anger, sadness, fear, joy, love. Some people argue that disgust is a basic emotion. Some people argue that shame and or guilt might be basic emotions. But sadness, fear, anger, joy, love, there's no question about. All human beings have the propensity to experience or the ability to experience and express those emotions, and all human beings make the same faces. And their bodies tend to respond in similar ways when they're experiencing and expressing those emotions. So when people are angry, they tend to attack or repel. When people are sad, they tend to cry and or withdraw. When people are afraid, they tend to flee or avoid, right, and so on. Now, when a person responds to an event of violation, when they've been violated and they express anger, so when somebody, you know, when you think of our ancestors, and imagine somebody living in one of our ancestors living in a cave, and somebody came to steal their fire and their food, our ancestors would have been mobilized by anger to get up, to like make to grimace, or to go grrr, to maybe pick up a rock and go and attack the person who was stealing their food. That's actually highly adaptive. It would have kept our ancestors living and procreating. And so when it's expressed in response to violation, it's considered a primary emotion. When a person expresses sadness in response to loss, it's a primary emotion. When somebody expresses fear in response to a threat, again, it's a primary emotion. It's primary because it's helpful, it's adaptive, it keeps the person alive, it helps the person maintain their well-being and the well-being of people they care about. When people respond with a different emotion, then it's a secondary emotion. So, for example, if you've been violated, but you express sadness, or if you've experienced loss, if your boyfriend or your girlfriend says, hey, you know, I'm not so happy in our relationship anymore, I'm thinking about leaving, right? So it's a loss situation, and you start raging, the person starts raging at their lover. That's secondary anger, secondary reaction, and it's almost never useful. And that is often what you see, the kinds of problems that people come into therapy with are often related to secondary emotions. So we teach our clients about emotions, we teach our clients about primary and secondary emotions, and we try to help our clients respond appropriately to emotional events. Of course, just because you're responding with a primary emotion doesn't mean that you're responding with the proper intensity of the emotion.
So thank you for that, Lauren. And now let's talk about also, you had mentioned that DBT was helpful for people with eating disorders as well as people with borderline personality disorder and also who have an addiction. What about people with just a general addiction?
Well, I wouldn't send somebody for DBT if they just had an addiction. Just because DBT is a pretty serious commitment. It's a comprehensive treatment involving usually 2 hours a week of skills training and an hour of individual therapy, plus all the therapists who are working on a team will meet together for at least an hour, if not 2 hours a week, for a consultation team, plus there's after-hours coaching. So that kind of intensity of treatment isn't going to be necessary for most people with addictions problems. And there are other treatments that have a lot of scientific support that you'd probably want to go to first. Some people who have, as you said, personality disorders or borderline personality disorder and co-occurring substance use disorders benefit from DBT or adaptations of DBT called DBTS.
Oh, what is DBTS?
Oh, it's just, you know, there's little mini acronyms that DBT folks have put on after DBT. So DBTS is DBT for substance use. So there are a number of adaptations and skills in the treatment for DBTS. So, for example, there's a hierarchy of targets in DBT. So DBT therapists always first focus on life-threatening behaviors in therapy. Then they focus on anything that interferes with treatment. And the third thing is they focus on anything that interferes with the quality of clients' lives. In DBT for substance use disorders, the substance use disorder is the first quality of life interfering behavior that gets priority. So after life-threatening behaviors and therapy interfering behaviors, therapists will focus usually then on substance use behaviors.
And Dr. Corman, when we were talking on the phone a few weeks ago when we were scheduling this interview, we had talked briefly about depression, and you had said that depression, specifically, you wouldn't actually prescribe DBT. So what kind of therapy would you prescribe for someone who has some kind of generalized depression?
Well, probably, again, it would be one of the therapies that have scientific support, so probably cognitive behavioral therapy, interpersonal therapy, emotion-focused therapy has scientific support behind it. Probably one of those therapies. I would definitely, if it was not a psychotherapy, I would want to look at the possibility of pharmacotherapy. And, of course, if somebody was depressed, you want to make sure that they had a full medical screen first to make sure that there wasn't some a medical condition that was contributing to them being depressed.
Thank you. So now, since the main topic of today's show is dialectical behavioral therapy, I was thinking that maybe we could go into some of the specific skills, if you're able to do that. So,
yeah, I would love to.
Okay. So I guess maybe, what do you usually start with, emotion regulation?
Typically, it's mindfulness. Typically, mindfulness is the first. It's the core skill. So all the other skills really are based on mindfulness. They don't work without mindfulness. And mindfulness gets the most airtime in the skills training groups.
And so do you, for me now, I work really hard at being mindful. And I notice that I'm able to be mindful of my emotions, and I'm able to recognize them and define them and identify them. And yet at the same time, I still have this, I'm still in the habit of, okay, I'm really feeling sad. I don't want to feel sad. And then I guess part of mindfulness is non-judgmental, right?
Yes.
But I tend to judge my emotion. And that often gets me more worked up because I recognize how I'm feeling and I don't like how I'm feeling. So what would you tell someone who's doing that behavior?
I'm not sure exactly what I would say. I think, you know, can you repeat what you said, Marie?
Sure. So for me, I will recognize the emotion. Typically, it will be sadness or frustration or a general overwhelmed feeling.
Yeah.
And I'm mindful of it. But then because I recognize the emotion, it's an unpleasant emotion. And so I feel like I don't want to feel this emotion. And that's when my thoughts kind of get carried away and I'll end up feeling worse and working myself up rather than using some other technique to allow it to pass. I sort of push it away or try to push it away, and that just makes it worse. So I'm wondering I'm wondering if you ever do this to yourself, and also what advice would you give someone who does that? Because I feel like that's pretty common.
Thanks for clarifying. I think one of the main ideas, like one of the things in dialectical behavior therapy is that it's dialectic, that for every idea there is an opposite idea, and that life is lived in the balance between these two opposite ideas. And so for if people are feeling, if people are having difficulty tolerating intense feelings, one important thing is to actually focus on distracting attention away from painful feelings, right? So when feelings get overwhelming or they're just too unpleasant to tolerate in the moment, one of the main ideas in DEBT is to teach people how to mindfully bring their attention away from the situation, away from the feeling, away from the bodily feelings that are associated with painful emotions. So, for example, you might do things like generate opposite emotions or soothe yourself by jumping in the shower or plunging your arm into a sink of cold water or by lighting candles or smelling essential oils, which are a way of actually powerfully bringing people's attention away from whatever is happening in the moment, right, to something else. And where attention goes, typically mood follows. Now, that is one strategy, which is a change strategy on the one hand, to, on the other hand, actually learning how to better just tolerate in the moment painful emotions. So learning how to sit with emotions without actually doing anything about them. But the funny thing is that as people learn ways to mindfully distract from pain, what typically happens is they're less freaked out by painful emotions. And so, you know what I mean? Like, the more people can kind of know that they can reliably get away from painful emotions, the more they're likely to actually sit with pain. Because the thing about emotions is they come and they go. And so sometimes people get really freaked out, understandably, or they get really upset because when you're in the midst of feeling strong emotions, they seem like they're here forever. But even the most painful emotions don't last forever. They come and they go. They're like the tides, right? They roll in, they roll out. And when people finally kind of learn that emotions are, they're temporal, right? All emotions are temporal. I think that what happens is they're less scared by them. But I think, you know, at the same time, you got to also have strategies for getting your mind away from pain so that you're not feeling completely overwhelmed by it.
Thank you, Lauren. So what comes up for me is that I get into, like, even though I have all these skills, and anyone I would imagine who's listening to this show would be pretty up to speed with skills and mindfulness and all of that. But it really is the practice. Because when you have an overwhelming emotion come up, you're not in, part of the dialectical behavioral therapy is the logical mind, the emotion mind, and in the middle, there's the wise mind. And the goal is to be in the wise mind more of the time than just living out of emotion mind or logical mind. But how do you, when you're in that emotion mind, I mean, you've got all of these hormones and things rushing through your body. So how do you stop yourself from being in emotion mind and getting yourself into wise mind?
Well, the idea, first of all, is that the person is always there. So the more you can actually, even when people are in emotion mind, teaching clients to learn to be reflective of the fact that they're in emotion mind. So, for example, clients come into therapy, they may be really dysregulated, they may be dissociative, but they, in the beginning of therapy, they may not even be able to say, to reflect on their experience. So they may be just raging or really, really upset, really afraid, and just be out of it, essentially be, you know, kind of pulled away by the undertow of their emotion. Over time, getting people to be more mindful, even if they're not in wise mind, helps them to be able to reflect on, you know what I mean, to take a step back and to reflect on what's going on. So, for example, a person then will say, you know what, you know, boy, oh, man, it's like I am really in emotion mind right now. I'm so angry. But even being able to be aware that their emotions are so intense, like the rest of us, and that at that moment it feels like their behaviors are being kind of ruled by their emotions, is one step away from kind of being pulled away by the waves of emotion. Do you know what I mean? And so, first of all, it's a matter of just reflecting on what's going on. And it may not be possible for a person in the moment when they're intensely in emotion mind, it might not be possible for the person to switch into wise mind. At the same time, they may be able to act wisely. We used to have run anger groups at CAMH where people would be really, really angry. And something would happen. They'd be really angry. They would be on the verge of leaving the session. And one of the therapists would say, you know, I'm wondering if you could just, would you be able to even click into wise mind just for a second as you're leaving? And sometimes people would just stop in the doorway. I mean, it didn't mean that their emotions, the intensity of their anger suddenly, you know, disappeared. But it did mean that they were there, like the person was fully there, and they were more than just their emotion. And that is one of the key messages in DBT. And that is that emotions are really important, they're really helpful, but we as human beings are not our emotions. And when we're in the midst of feeling things really intensely, it feels like we are our emotions. And when we feel like we are, you know, our whole bodies and souls are our emotions, then it's really, unfortunately, easy to kind of be carried away by them.
So, Lauren, now I'm curious, we have emotions for a reason. So there's a purpose for the fact that when we have an intense emotion, we tend to act from that emotion rather than our logical mind. Isn't it a survival instinct?
You're absolutely right. It is. When it's functioning properly, it is. So the reason that we feel, if we didn't feel sad, you're absolutely right. If when babies don't feel sad, they don't cry, they don't get nurtured by typically their mothers, and they don't thrive or they die, right? When people don't express anger, they are unable to actually stand up for their rights and they don't thrive. When people are not afraid, you know what happens, right? They die, right? They're not able to back off of dangerous situations, right? They put their head, you know, you see this even with physical pain, right? People who are born with, you know, with some anomaly who are unable to experience physical pain, oh, we think, oh, that's fantastic, but it's not fantastic, it's awful, right? They'll play hockey and they'll, you know, rather than kind of move, once they get thwacked on their knees, rather than move their legs away, they'll keep their leg open and then keep their leg extended and will break their leg. So you're absolutely right, emotions are incredibly important, they're highly adaptive, we tend not to survive with them, without them, and they've been evolved over the millennia for good reason. But it doesn't mean that they can't misfunction. And particularly when, unfortunately, when folks are either really born extremely sensitive or vulnerable to negative emotions. So, for example, some people are just feel things more intensely, or it takes very little to get them going, or maybe it not only does it take little to get them going, but it takes a long time for them for their emotions to return to baseline, or because of some kind of learning that's taken place. So, for example, you know, we think about neglect or abuse. People's emotions can become quite dysregulated and work against them. And you see this, unfortunately, with people, right, who are overwhelmed by their sadness, or they've got one gear, unfortunately, and it's anger. They're angry all the time. You don't see sadness. You don't see fear. You don't see love or joy or vulnerability. You see anger all the time. And that, those kinds of examples, for example, it makes sense if somebody's been violated repeatedly when they've been a child over and over and over and over. I'm not saying all anger problems are the result of being violated as a child, but if you've been violated over and over and over and you've been told you don't have a right to express anger, well, the moment you have a chance, you're going to tend to be expressing a lot of anger and see the world as a very violating place. But as an adult, it tends not to be a very functional way of being. People don't want to be around you when you're angry all the time.
Exactly. Well, it's time for a break now, so we will be back with more Synchronicity in a moment. This is Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Today we are speaking with Dr. Lauren Corman. He is a psychologist at the Vancouver Psychotherapy Center, and we will be back in a moment. But if you want to get on the air and ask him a question, the number is 604-822-2487. That's 604-822-2487.
It is Monday.
From 1 to 3 p.m.
Who is this guy? Does he have a name? Let me know where he's from.
From parts unknown.
My name's Chris Horrific.
You always wanted his character to be bigger than life.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is without question the greatest sports and entertainment event of all time. Be a part of it. Monday.
From 1 to 3 p.m.
The Parts Unknown Show on 101.9 CITR. Sometimes cosmoses collide.
The Parts Unknown!
Break your fingers!
Welcome back to Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. That was a promo for DJ Chris Horrific. He's going to be up in about 15 minutes here on CITR with Parts Unknown. This is Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. I hope you're having a wonderful holiday season. If you're Jewish, happy Hanukkah to you. We're somewhere in the middle of Hanukkah right now, so happy Hanukkah. And right now we are speaking with Dr. Lauren Corman. He is from the Vancouver Psychotherapy Center. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Lauren.
Hi.
Hey,
nice
thank you.
Here.
And we have someone here at the station who came in. Did you have a question or are you just wanting to sit in?
Just want to sit in.
Just want to sit in? Okay, cool. So he's liking our conversation. Now, where were we? We were talking about emotions and how some people have more sensitivity, or if they've gone through some kind of trauma, abuse, neglect, then they're going to have more dysregulated emotions. So
you were saying that even though they are, emotions are really helpful typically, they're really adaptive, they still can become really dysregulated and stop working for the person.
So my question for you is, what about these people who, because I've talked about this on my show, I had neglect and abuse and all that. I grew up in foster care. It was a hell hole. But anyway, so that's why I've been in DBT and it's been really helpful to me. But I still find that I am extremely, I would probably call myself a highly sensitive person. So I am quick to react. And even though I do have these mindfulness skills and I have exceptional interpersonal effectiveness skills and all of that, they still come up and it's still a constant challenge. So for people who are just generally more sensitive, whether it's just in their biology or because of something that happened to them, are they ever going to be less sensitive?
Oh, I think so. Absolutely. I mean, are they going to ever be not sensitive? Probably not. And nobody would want to not be. I mean, I can't imagine that many people would want to be not sensitive at all. So if you're born highly sensitive, you may always be a sensitive person, but I don't think that you need to be highly sensitive. I mean, what you see often is people will be sensitive to particular kinds of cues. So they're not necessarily sensitive to everything. So for example, some people will be very sensitive to cues of rejection. Some people will be very sensitive to cues of violation. Some people will be very sensitive to other kinds of cues of loss. People will be very sensitive to any kinds of cues associated with shame, for example. Something will happen in a group, for example, where the next thing you know, the person is incredibly angry and nobody knows what just happened. Or the person felt, something happened where the person felt incredibly ashamed and then reacted with secondary anger, where shame was the first emotion because they were very highly sensitive to shame. So there you have two different kinds of dysfunction, of emotional dysfunction, in the same person, in the same moment, unfortunately, where you've got very high sensitivity to shame, but no awareness of that, and then reaction with a secondary, a reaction to the shame is anger, where the person is then lashing out at other people. But you can reduce that, and we've done that with many clients, and most DB therapists do that for a living. You know, they will, with their client's permission, they will find out the kinds of cues, the kinds of situations that if the person's really sensitive to shame situations, they'll find out that those kinds of situations that they're really sensitive to, and they will figure out how to actually come up with a hierarchy, come up with a list of, together with their clients, of situations that evoke intense shame, and they'll strengthen, they'll toughen their clients up. Basically, they'll expose them to situations, not like horrible shame-producing situations, but situations that in the past otherwise would have evoked intense shame. So, for example, you ask somebody, hey, have you done your homework? And the client hasn't done their homework. And whereas, you know, maybe you would say, oh, you know, I'm sorry, let's talk about what happened that I didn't do my homework. If a person was intensely, intensely sensitive to shame, they might explode in the session. So you might, for example, with your client, make up a whole list of things that the person has not done as well as they wanted to, and you would talk about it with the client until the intensity of their shame came down. And those kinds of interventions, they work, right? And people will get less sensitive to them. They'll react less with anger. They'll react less with shame. They'll react less with fear.
So it sounds like you're almost saying it's similar to, like, if someone has a phobia, like they're scared of flying, then they would expose themselves to flying again and again to become desensitized to it.
That is exactly right. It is almost the same thing, in fact.
Interesting. Well, we only have 10 minutes left in the show, and I may or may not play a song, depending on how much time we have. So I'm wondering if there's anything, any direction that you would like to focus in for the last bit of the show.
Good question. Well, I mean, I just wanted to say, you know, that DBT is a great, I've spent most of my adult career doing DBT. There are other forms of therapy that also work well with people with borderline personality disorder. There's just not that available typically in Canada. I guess what I want to say is one of the main contributions for that DBT made, that Marshall Linehan made in particular, was that there really weren't any scientifically supported treatments for borderline personality disorder before 1991, 1993, before she started publishing in the area. I guess one of the things that concerns me, and I don't know how we would focus on this, is that basically there are so few publicly funded services in British Columbia, particularly for adults with borderline personality disorder. And of course, we're talking mostly for women who have been traumatized, right? For women who have been physically, sexually, emotionally traumatized and abused. I'm not exactly sure how we would focus on this, but I didn't want to state this because this is an ongoing concern. And most folks who have sought treatment in British Columbia will know this, that if they don't have money, the actual treatments that are available to them are minimal. And so what then happens is they may or may not get a diagnosis of borderline personality disorder if they see a physician. And there is no medication, there is no first-line medication treatment for borderline personality disorder. So for people with BPD, treatments, ancillary treatments can be, like medications can be very helpful, right? But they're not going to target the whole borderline personality disorder. So that itself, the medication itself is not curative. It can reduce impulsivity or it can, you know, reduce irritability, but it will not be able to target the disorder as a whole. And this is a huge issue, in my opinion anyways, in British Columbia, that there are not more publicly funded treatments available, particularly for adult women with borderline personality disorder.
Thank you very much for that. And so, because if you have something like schizophrenia or manic depression or something like that, you can go to like a mental health team. So it sounds like you're saying for someone with a personality disorder, there's no access to free or government-funded care.
Well, I guess the question is, what is the government-funded care that these folks get? Some of the mental health teams, I think, welcome people with borderline personality disorder. Some do not. But there's not a medication. So there's no, it's not a medication. So, for example, if somebody is diagnosed with bipolar affective disorder, if they have what we used to call manic depression, then there is a medication-first treatment for that. But there isn't for borderline personality disorder. And so what you tend to see, unfortunately, is that people who will go for treatment and they won't be diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, either because the care provider may be worried about the stigma associated with the diagnosis, or because it's just easier to treat somebody, frankly, with a different disorder with medication than it is actually having to find psychosocial treatments like psychotherapy that doesn't exist in the publicly funded system in British Columbia, or that hardly exists.
Well, that brings up another question, and we do just have a few minutes left, but I even had a neuroscientist who is schizophrenic. You've probably heard of her. She was on the cover of the Georgia Strait a few months ago. And even she had a hard time getting diagnosed with schizophrenia. So whenever there's a mental health condition, it can take a really long time to get an accurate diagnosis, correct?
Yes, it can, yeah.
And so what are some of the reasons for that, do you think?
I don't know globally. I mean, it may just have to do with the limits and available services in BC. Now, sometimes it may have to do with the fact of how the person presents in one time. You know, so for example, if somebody's under the use of under the influence of substances, it's very hard actually to make a clear diagnosis until the person's been clean for about 30 to 60 days. With BPD, though, I think it's a specific problem with borderline personality disorder, and that is because I think clinicians are reluctant to diagnose people with BPD, partly I think because there's a stigma that there's been a long history of blaming people with borderline personality disorder, right, that they're, you know, impulsive and they're difficult people and nobody wants to work with them, which I think much more reflected, I think, the lack of availability of treatments that worked in the past. But now there are lots of treatments that work, right? There's mentalization, there's transference-based psychotherapy, there's DBT and so forth. And so there's really no excuse not to diagnose somebody with borderline personality disorder. But the only problem is that the publicly funded treatments don't exist.
So is there any way as a psychotherapist that you would encourage people to, I mean, how do we go about changing that?
That's a million-dollar question. I think that folks with BPD, when they're right in the middle of it, they're not going to probably be in a great place to be able to galvanize, you know, to group us together. I think that they've got to go to they're members of parliament, frankly, or they're members of the legislative assembly. I think that without some kind of political mobilization, there will be no change in the public system. I think for one thing, I think that folks with money unfortunately get treatment in BC. So if you can come up with the money to go to one of the centers that treat people with borderline personality disorder, right, there's a couple of them, right? Then you can get treatment. We've got a number of psychiatrists. I mean, we've tried to kind of figure out how to actually make the services available to people who either have no money or who have little money. But I think that folks need to galvanize to force the health authorities, to put pressure on the health authorities, to come up with the money, to come up with the political will to actually fund multidisciplinary treatment services where they belong, places like St. Paul's Hospital and, you know, other places where we know folks who, places that treat, for example, the downtown Lower East Side, these people they're vulnerable. They've been victimized. About three-quarters of them have been victimized. They're vulnerable. They're not necessarily going to be showing up on voting day to vote. They're disenfranchised part of our citizenry who are not getting treated. But I think until we figure out, I don't know the answer to that, really, Marie, but until we figure out how to bring pressure to bear on the political system, I don't think anything will change here.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time, Dr. Lauren Korman. That is all the time we have today because Parts Unknown is coming up in just a moment. So I want to thank you so much. And does the Vancouver Psychotherapy Center have a website? How can people get in touch with you?
Oh, we do. We have a website. I think it's Vancouver Psych... DP, I'll just actually check. It tells you how much I know about our own website. I'm looking. You can look for us at vanpsych.com. VANPSYCH.com.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time. That is all the time we have today, so I'm going to have to let you go. But I really appreciate your time and your knowledge, and thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right. So again, that was Dr. Lauren Korman, and you can find him. He has that the Vancouver Psychotherapy Center. This has been Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'll be back next Monday, and then that'll be it for the rest of the year for Synchronicity. So happy holidays. Happy Hanukkah. Be well. I love you so much. Namaste.
I'm going to be around my vegetables. I'm going to chow down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable.
Sprouts. It's your 75-cent coffee fix in the sub.
It's your source for reasonably priced, creatively named stew and vegan brownies.
It's your purveyor of bicycle-delivered local produce.
It's also a place where volunteers can realize their vision of responsible business and where like-minded students can explore UBC's food systems.
Hark! Sprouts is currently accepting applications for next year's executive board and is encouraging ambitious, creative, and disciplined students from all faculties and year levels to apply.
Come by Sprouts in the sub-basement to learn more about our projects and how to get involved.
I tried to kick the ball, but my tinny flew right off. I'm red as a beet, 'cause I'm so embarrassed.
She's a bad.
Tired of hearing your band playing on and on and on. Gosh, so loud.
Man, I wish we had a safe place to play music.
Yeah, and shows too.
The Safe Amplification Site Society is a non-profit group dedicated to establishing a legal, affordable, all-ages venue for music and arts in Vancouver. For more information or to get involved, check out www.safeamp.org.
LiveVan.com is Vancouver's community-driven concert calendar. New shows are added daily by the city's most active promoters, musicians, and by the driving force of the music scene, the fans. LiveVan.com's listings are different because they are integrated with profiles updated by bands and business owners as they promote upcoming events. Check out the archives to see how closely we've worked within the community to put on the shows you love. Visit LiveMusicVancouver.com for the latest independent and major label event listings. LiveVan.com, Vancouver's community-driven concert calendar.
On Friday, December 14th, the Holiday Hustle begins with the second annual benefit for the W2 Community Media Arts Society. Over three floors of performances, including The Librarian vs. Self-Evident, Mandai, Vendettas, Bastet, Cherchez la Femme, and many more. Check Holiday Hustle 2 on eventbrite.ca for special deals or grab tickets at W2, Beat Street, Zulu, High Life, and Red Cat.
You are listening to 101.9 CITR. This is the Parts Unknown Show.
So very hard to do. If you really love him, and there's nothing I can do. Don't try to spare my feelings, just tell me that we're through. And make it easy on you. And if the way I hold you can compare to his grace, no words of consolation will make me miss you less, my darling. If this is goodbye, I just know I'm gonna cry. So run to him before you start crying too, and make
lovely job by the Walker Brothers, a tune called Make It Easy on Yourself, penned by Burt Bacharach and Hal David back in the 60s. That song was recorded in 1965. Now, the reason why I play it, hello, my name is Chris. This is the Parts Unknown Show. And the reason why I play it is that last week I re-bought the Scott Walker album Bish Bosh, which is his recent one. And long story, but I got into a car accident, and not my fault, but the lady came out of nowhere and I T-boned her, and everyone's okay. But I got a car in the meantime while ICBC checks on my old car. Hopefully it's not a write-off, you never know. Anyway, the car that I'm driving right now, completely stressed out of driving this car because it's nice. So it has a CD player, and I put in a Bish Bosh by Scott Walker. It is all over the place. People that review that album, they don't want to be... they don't want to say what they want to say. They want to say that it's crazy. It's recorded by a crazy man. It truly is. It's all over the place. There's this 20-minute song that goes nowhere. Absolutely nowhere. It hits the wall, hits the ceiling, hits the floor, but it doesn't go straight. It's never... Oh my gosh, listen to it. I can't play it anymore. I played one track from it, and that was like the hit. But there isn't any hits. If that song that I played last week was the hit, then the rest of it is just meandering nonsense. Sorry, Jarrett. Dating Myself is a band out of Vancouver, British Columbia. And Laura Lee Schultz is one of the head songwriters, kind of a 90s pop-tinged act. There's a backstory to this band, but I won't get into the backstory. I will just get into the tune, Splinters, from the album Fine There. This is the three-piece act, Dating Myself, on 101.9 CITR. Oh my gosh, really? It's doing this thing again? Okay, I have to go back and see if we can try this one more time. How about we just go like this, go like this, and then go like this. They go like this. Oh my gosh. Painful. Anyway, how about I go to another track while this is doing its thing? We will play that in a second, but how about we play a little gentleman that came to prominence in the early 90s. I love him so much. When I was hearing the music of Dating Myself, I was thinking of all the great pop acts that came out of the 90s, and this gentleman was right at the top of his game. From the album 100% Fun, I am of course speaking of Mr. Matthew Sweet. He had an album called 100% Fun, and from it, a tune called Get Older. You are listening to 101.9 CITR. This is the Parts Unknown show. That was... This is...
Hey!
Oh my gosh, what a mess! But let's see if this show can be saved with the CD version of this tune. Yep, this is the one. Well, we'll see. This is dating myself. Four songs from the past to support the two current songs that I am to play. And damn it, I will play them. Come hell or high water.
I may be missing out.
Ben Lai.
Hello.
It finally, we had some problems that you're looking at your watch already. Ben Lai, that was a band called...
Pubs, is what you played?
Pubs?
Pups, I don't know. Puppies.
It's a song, P-E-I.
P-E-I, perfect. Muscles.
What's muscles?
P-E-I muscles.
Oh, I've never had P-E-I muscles. Are they really good? Does Edward Island have the best muscles?
As good as P.E.I. potatoes.
Have you been to the craw? Like that crawfish place or crayfish? Okay. That, I can't believe that there's a place in Vancouver that you can get crayfish. And I haven't jumped on
Have you had crayfish?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. I went to Maine one time and there was lobster and crayfish and stuff. Yeah. So, yeah.
Good.
All right.
I dissected one in high school. Keep going.
No, you didn't.
Yes, I did.
Yeah. That was Pops. I've been trying for 20 minutes to try to play this song to any of the DJs. The Internet Explorer is not working very well. That was P.E.I., little tune. Then before that was the band Dating Myself. Who's in it?
Laura Lee.
Schultz. You don't even... well... She has been... Name three other bands that she's been in.
New Year's Resolution.
Very good.
But in Dating Myself, I was why because her name is actually Lorida.
Lorida Schultz?
No, it's...
Which Lorida. Is Lorida, okay.
And then there's... Yeah.
And then there's a member of the band that has a six in the...
Yeah, yeah, that's why I'm remembering.
It's okay. Yeah. You always struggle here. Dating Myself had the tune Splinters from an album. I forget what it's called. I'm so sorry. Myself.
Names are on there. Joy 6 or something like that.
Go ahead. That was Dating Myself. Also, then we had a whole bunch of 90s songs way from not your past, but Ben's and ours, since we're old. And...